Yeah, I guess you could draw a parallel to cooking. Is you got to know what the ingredients are separately, but how they interact with the other ingredients and what they do together.
That's Lyle Workman. I'm Jamie Green, and this is Trading Fours. Hey everybody, welcome back to another edition of Trading Fours. I am your host, Jamie Green, and today we have Lyle Workman on the podcast, which is going to be so much fun. What do you love about movies, people? Is it the script? Is it the production value? Is it the director? Do you love the producer? Just the theme of the movie? What do you love about it? Well, for a lot of us, we love the music of the movie. And you know, when you think music of a movie, you think soundtrack, right? You're thinking about, well, I mean, I'm gonna date myself, but back in the 80s, you know, Kenny Loggins wrote all these songs that were part of soundtracks, and that was hip. But there's a lot more than just the soundtrack hits. There is the actual movie score or TV score, all the songs that give the movie or the television show its character. And it's pretty ubiquitous, and you probably don't notice it unless you pay attention to it. But once you do, I think you're going to be like, wow, you're right. It's on all the time. And today's guest is one of the best at doing that, setting that mood and that scene and that feeling. I'm not going to list all of his credits because he's got a bazillion. But just some of the ones you may be aware of. Well, for one thing, Superbad, which is awesome. Chef, I love the movie Chef. American Reunion. The wonderful Burt Wonderstone, stand-up guys, and then on the TV front, he has done a ton. Crashing is the one show we're going to talk about today. So Lyle Workman is really prolific, but that's not his whole career. That's just a portion of it. Lyle is also an amazing guitarist and songwriter who has done things on his own and has collaborated with folks. Some of those people you'll know, Sting for one, you can look. Lyle toured with Sting. Another one, Beck. There's a million of them. So I'd been aware of Lyle for a long time. Actually, first became aware of him back in the 1990s because he was one of the people, back to the jellyfish thing. I'm sorry, but I know we talk about it a lot. But Jason Faulkner left the band, they tried out some guitar players. They didn't find anybody right away, and they were making a second album, so they had some people play on it. And one of the two people who played on that is Lyle Workman. So I've been aware of Lyle since then. Great career. So I reached out. He could not have been nicer. Super sweet guy. He said, sure. And this is our conversation. So I think you're really going to enjoy it. So let's get started. Here's my conversation with Lyle Workman. Let's just go ahead and get started. I think, you know, the reason why, obviously, you've had a very prolific career and I've been well aware of you for a long time, but you're really the first person I've had on who has done movie scoring. Mm-hmm. And you've done a lot of movie scoring, and this is a whole different animal. Would you say that's correct?
Oh, yeah.
And so from a complete layperson that knows nothing about movie scoring, I would think that it's a very specific skill set you have to have, and you have to be pretty prolific, because a lot of these, I was looking at some of your listings here, I mean, you're writing 12 songs for just a single show, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. And then some. You can have it just depends on the movie. You know, some movies have a lot of score, some don't have that much, but then it could be a situation where there's not a whole lot of score if you add up the minutes, but you have to do several revisions, and sometimes you start from scratch, and that can go on quite a bit.
But you know,
the process, it really depends on the process, the people you work with and the project. It varies quite a bit.
So I saw your name on Crashing, and my wife and I love that show.
Yeah.
I just thought it had a real sweet sensibility to it. Right. And I mean, part of that is just kind of his personality and stuff, but
sure.
I was sad that they didn't give it a fourth season.
Yeah, we did three seasons, and I was hoping it would go further myself, but yeah, I don't know how they do things over at Netflix. You know, they're a substantial entity by now.
So for something like that, does I assume Judd Apatow was one of his projects too, correct?
This is production.
Okay.
This production.
So when he talks to you about the show, is it one of these things where he's like, it's a comic, he's living on couches, he's in you? I mean, how much background do you get to start your process?
Well, usually I see a cut of the show. Either we meet in person or we have a conference call and just discuss the key points and the music, the stylistic options that the director or the showrunner is really not the director. See, in TV, in a movie, you have a director who directs the whole movie, right? With TV, you have multiple directors. You have a showrunner who performs essentially like the director, although sometimes the director or the showrunner on a TV show can be a writer. So they're not behind the camera, not all the time, with a bunch of different directors directing. It's very odd for a director to direct a TV show, direct every episode. It's I guess you could call it guest directors, so to speak.
Yeah.
But Judd was, his position on that show was as a producer. So ultimately it does go to him. I mean, everything kind of goes to him at the 10-yard line. And he says, yeah, can we do this or change this edits? Might have notes, music notes. We may have a picture notes.
And he seems kind of like he's a music nut. Is that fair?
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. So what's Judd's like sensibility music wise? Does he just love it all? Does he have certain people that are his favorites? What's his kind of?
He likes all kinds of music, you know, popular music, pop music, rock music, modern stuff. I mean, he's real well versed in music.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious about all this. So you've been doing it for quite, how many years have you been doing this now? I mean, you've been doing this for quite a while.
Well, scoring, I'd done an independent film in 2002, but then 2001. And then in 2003 is when I did 40-Year-Old Virgin, which kind of started, that really started the career.
How was Judd aware of you?
He found out about me. Well, I think he was aware, might have been aware of me with just being in the bands I've been in. I played with Frank Black for a while from the Pixies, right. About 5 records. And just being a music fan, I might have been on his radar. But what had happened is I had done a favor for a music executive. Vice president at Universal Pictures had some music and he wanted a guitar on it. And so another film composer of mine who I had done some work with, his name is Ed Schirmer. He called me, said, told me the story. The vice president of music needs some guitar for a personal project. Lyle, I know you want to get into scoring more. It might not be a bad idea to do this guy a favor. And so the executive came into my studio. I played guitar on his project. And prior, I'd made a CD with music I had done for this independent film and some jingle stuff I'd written for. I'd previously had worked for a jingle agency writing some jingles and just put it all together and some instrumental stuff because I'd done a couple instrumental records and sent them off with the CD. And I thought I'd never hear from him. The executive called me back, said, I really like what you're doing and you play guitar, but you can score. And in fact, would you want to try to submit some additional music for a film that we have coming out in Universal? It was a Will Ferrell film.
Okay.
And I submitted some music and ended up in the movie. And Judd Apatow was the producer of that movie, a producer. And then Judd signed a deal with Universal as a director. And for his first movie, the executives was talked about me and said, maybe you should give this kid a try since he did such a nice job on the Will Ferrell film. And I demoed a few scenes and got the gig. And that was 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Okay.
And then it was, you know, 2 weeks at number one. So I kind of skipped ahead of the class. And then the next movie after that was Superbad, and that was also 2 weeks at number one. So I had a good amount of success pretty much out of the gate with the feature films.
So as a musician, is it, I mean, obviously I assume you like the challenge of it. I assume that's part of the reason why that you find it rewarding. Is there also the fact that you don't have to be on the road 9-10 months out of the year, or you're kind of in control, at least, you know, in your studio? I mean, what makes you really like it?
Well, I do like the fact that I'm writing the music, and also in scenario, I'll be in scenarios where I get all these opportunities to work with musicians and orchestras. And you know, it's a bigger responsibility, you know, whereas in my experience of touring, I'm touring backing up a band or an artist. And it feels like, for me, it feels like I'm living their dream, not necessarily my dream. You finish the tour and then that's kind of it. You know, you spend the money. I mean, it's really fun. I really enjoy playing live. There's lots of things I really love about it. But you're not necessarily further in your own career. Whereas with film, you can build, you're building on your own skill set in an area that can expand and grow in other areas.
No, I totally get that. And how has it improved you as a songwriter overall, just doing it for so many?
I think you just said doing it just by sheer volume. You know, when you're writing hours and hours of music, it's just a muscle, you know, that you're honing.
Well, that's great. I just, it's such an interesting thing to me. You know, it's one of those things with movies, you don't think about it until it's not there, right? I mean, it's become such a part of the whole movie experience. I don't think people even recognize it half the time that the music is setting the scene, or kind of, especially like, you know, when it's like a murder thing and, you know, the tension, you know, music's tension and release, right, Lyle? There's a lot of that part of it too. So, but it's so ubiquitous. I mean, I'm sure you're pretty busy with it.
Yeah, well, music, to me, it's another character in the movie or TV show. It's another character, and it can provide subtext and things that aren't so readily available just by looking at it. And yeah, it's fun. I really enjoy the process. I enjoy good TV. I enjoy great movies. I like being up that cog in that wheel.
Totally. Well, I know you had an album out this year. How is it releasing an album during a pandemic? I mean, that's got to be a strange kind of thing to deal with. You don't promote it like a usual way, I'm guessing. You do it like this on a Zoom call. Can you walk me through that? Like what it was for you, how it was for you?
Yeah, well, the record was actually finished just at the beginning, like it was being mixed in January and February of last year. So right when stuff was hitting hard. So my idea was, I think I'm just going to wait and release it this year, 2021. It came out in February of 2021. And I mean, it's a different kind of record. It's a record I made with a 63-piece orchestra at Abbey Road. So there's really no getting in the van and playing at the local jazz club.
No.
So a lot of the stuff was not really different than what it would be have been without COVID in terms of promotion and getting the awareness out of it.
So for the Abbey Road thing, does it take a while just to be like, it's another studio? I mean, you can't walk through that front door, right? And not know the history. The amazing musical hit. I mean, when my family and I, we were in London 3 years ago, my older son's a huge Beatles nut. I mean, we had to go drive by, stop. We had to annoy Londoners and take a picture of the four of us walking across the crosswalk.
Of course.
What is it like for someone who's just there to work?
It's everything you would imagine for anybody that's a Beatle fan. Just like being in the most revered musical church you could think of, which would be Abbey Road in terms of all that great music that came out of it, the significance. So there's that. That's just there in the back of your mind. And then also just the what bowled me over was the sound of the room. Just being in the room and hearing music made in it. It's just a very distinctive sound. You know, the atmosphere and the sonics in that room are very, it doesn't sound like any other place. It just has a magical feeling. And of course, it's imbued by your history of Beatle lore and love. So that's all mixing around in your head.
So is there like pictures up of them? I mean, how much do they play on the fact that, hey,
No, the studios themselves, I mean, they look exactly the same. The tile and the acoustic, the tile and the baffles and the ground and the floor. The things that have changed considerably are the control rooms. They're a lot more modern. Of course, it's all modern gear and modern speakers and modern sound enhancement on the walls and those kinds of things. That's all brand new and modern. But when you're in the rooms where people are playing, the tracking rooms, that's where it's like a throwback.
63 people is a lot of music to write for. I mean, because, you know, you're writing different parts for the first section, the second section. I mean, my dad was he was a big band guy, and then he actually was a high school band director and then worked for a college band. So I kind of, I grew up in that world.
That's great.
So, you know, the guys that are on the first part of the trumpet, they're not playing the same part as the guys that are further down the line with the trumpet. And that's the same for everybody, whether it's reeds or winds or whatever. So how is it like being a chef? Is that what it is? Like, you're like in your mind, you're mixing and matching these things to have it be the right colors. Like, how do you approach that? I'm curious about that.
It's like, I guess you could draw a parallel to cooking. Is you got to know what the ingredients are separately, but how they interact with the other ingredients and what they do together. So that's very similar. It really just, for me, it comes from listening to a lot of music when I was a kid and growing up, and starting with the Beatles, with George Martin's influence on the Beatles and orchestral textures. And then also the music of the 60s and 70s had, just on the radio, there were elements of that stuff in popular music, and then even bands like Moody Blues or Electric Light Orchestra, you know, with the string section.
Yep.
So it was always something I really liked. And then that the use of orchestral music or textures and instrumentation in jazz, like with Gil Evans' work with Miles Davis.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's beautiful stuff.
Nelson Riddle with Frank Sinatra, right? I mean, that was another.
Oh, yeah. Nelson Riddle, Klaus Ogerman, you know, the just incredible. Claire Fisher, just. I've always liked that sound in music.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not classical music, it's just orchestras playing popular music or jazz or whatever, film music, just the sound of an orchestra, the sound of strings, 40 strings playing together. It's just a sound that just is a thing. I love that sound.
No, it's a beautiful sound, you know, and I think for people who are listening to this and know what Abbey Road was, but I mean, like, you know, A Day in the Life, is the song A Day in the Life that magical and that meaningful without that George Martin piece where he writes, you know, the orchestration on that and how they go from the lowest note to the highest note in a certain amount of, I mean, it makes the tune.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I think of She's Leaving Home Without Orchestra.
Right.
What would that sound like?
Yeah.
It should be a good song. I mean, a great song could be played on a vocal and guitar or vocal and piano. That a great song transcends instrumentation.
So back to your songs, writing for soundtracks, it almost seems like every soundtrack has its own personality. Would you say that's right?
That's exactly right.
And I'm guessing Superbad was just a ton of fun. Was Superbad just, I mean, from listening to it, I mean, you got to hang out with Bootsy Collins, right? That's got to be cool.
It was great. It was great because of hanging out with Bootsy and the other guy, Clyde and Jabbo and Bernie Worrell. I mean, yeah, that whole group was, it was like a history. It was like going to, like a funk hall of fame.
Yeah.
A funk hall of fame jam session with all those guys. But somehow I was leading the charge. And it was great fun. And they had a great time being together again. They hadn't seen each other in a long time, that group of people. And we recorded over 4 days at Capitol Records and rehearsed every cue. We didn't have a bunch of readers there. Bernie Worrell read music, but he was the only one in the core Superbad band. So we would rehearse the cues. And I would also direct them with a microphone because the drummer Jabbo said, why don't you just tell us, you know, while you're playing, just, you know, remind us of where we're going, like the next section. And so I realized that I'm kind of doing a James Brown's type of thing.
Yeah.
Not quite as funky. But that was a great experience.
It sounds like a great experience. And then, you know, we just talked about Abbey Road. Capitol Records is another place. Nat King Cole and, you know, all those guys. Yeah.
You walk into the room and now they do have all the pictures of Frank.
Do they?
Nat. Yeah. And it's great. You walk in through the hallway and then leading to the main studios. And there's on both the left and right, there's these beautiful black and white photos.
Definitely. So what's 2022 hold for you? Do you know what you're going to be up to for the next 6 months to a year?
It's a little uncertain right now. It's a little uncertain. I came off of a bunch of work in my record. And then there's, you know, irons in the fire. You know, there's some potential movie projects and some TV stuff, but nothing set in stone yet. So yeah, you caught me in between having anything to promote or talk about in terms
All right.
Yeah.
The whole idea was this is like, I just want it to be a conversation and just kind of like, you know, if you and I were on a commute together and just kind of, that's what I find interesting. Like, I know that a lot of people interview and it's like going to be talk about that album or I did a lot of reading on your stuff, background stuff, and everybody asks you about Sting and that's fine, but I'm not going to ask you about Sting just because you've been asked it so much. Right. I don't think that you're going to have anything I'm sure you enjoyed it, but you've been asked enough about it. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm fine with that. I'm fine with just the very flowing nature of how you want to roll.
No, I think it's more fun that way. So, well, the last thing about Superbad is it's become part of the culture. I saw a lot of people on Twitter were having fun with Aaron Rodgers, and then his COVID card was the McLovin card. They just took McLovin's face. Have you seen that?
I have not seen that.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. And everybody knew what it meant, right? It's hilarious. So I got a kick out of that so much. Well, you don't know this, but I'm a huge jellyfish nerd. Mm. I've had Jason Faulkner on, I've had Eric Dover on, I've had Tim Smith on, I've had Roger on.
Andy?
No, Andy, I know. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
So that's interesting to me because it seems like musicians love it just about, you know, it's one of those bands that like, it's almost like a secret password. Like, have you been? So I'm curious. This was a short part of your life, right? I mean, you came in and you played on the album.
Yeah.
And Eric actually went out on tour later.
Right.
So what was it like for you?
Well, I enjoyed being a part of what I thought was a great record. I thought those guys wrote incredible songs with incredible ideas. Incredible production, and I was just happy to be a part of it. Really thrilled to be a part of that recording of that record.
Do you know which tracks exactly you played on? Do you remember that, or is it just kind of a blur?
Yeah, yeah. The credits don't credit me and John Bryan. I'm on about 50% of the record, I guess.
So maybe, like Russian Hill, did you play on that one? Or was that John?
I don't think that's John even. I think that's Dean Parks.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a studio guy. The songs that I'm on, let me see if I can remember them off the top of my head. Gluttonous Sympathy.
Right.
New Mistake.
Well, those are two big ones. I mean, yeah. New Mistake is probably the song that people know the most off that album.
Goes to number one.
Yeah.
Me. Then, yeah, I'm about half of it.
And then did you get the call, or how did that all go down?
Well, Andy and Roger were in a band called Beatnik Beach from the San Francisco Bay Area. And I was in a band it was based in Sacramento, but we had pretty good presence in all of the Bay, because we were doing, you know, kind of a big fish I wouldn't say we were big fish in a small pond. We were just coming up in that area and doing a lot of gigging in San Francisco and all across the South Bay and San Francisco. So you get to know other bands and other people. And I think Beatnik Beach actually opened for my band. And so the funny thing about it is, when I heard the first Jellyfish record, I thought it was this great new band from England.
Right.
So when I found out that they were not from England, but they were from my neck of the woods, and that their band, the previous band that Andy and Roger in, opened up for my band, I simply sought them out and said, if you guys ever need a guitar player, because Bourgeois Attack had disbanded, said I would love to participate. And they said, well, actually, we're doing demos for a record right now. I can't remember who I talked to, if it was Roger or Andy. But we spoke on the phone, and they just said, come on up to Guitati and play on these demos.
They liked what they heard, and you went back and did the actual album.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
How are those two together?
Well, they're very much focused, focused on making a record. It was their second record, so I think there was a little bit more pressure to, you know, usually you only get two chances with a major label, and if it doesn't happen,
right,
they let you go. And even though the first record was well received, I don't think it was I don't think that they sold tons of records, so it was important that they make it right. So I think there was just nose to the grindstone, concentrated work.
Well, and then I'll say one thing, and then we can move on. And you made the joke about Andy. It's interesting to me that somebody who was the front man of the band, like, he's really made a concerted effort to pull back and not be involved. And, you know, everybody else was pretty easy to get them. You know, they're very outgoing and friendly and a lot of personality. Do you ever run into him, just since you guys
the last time I saw him was, gosh, it's probably 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I was hired to write some sound alikes for some video games. And I did, We Are the Champions. It was for a movie, a potential movie. But there was something that he had me do after that. I played guitar on this Puffy Yumi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was way into that.
Yeah, so he had me play guitar on that. So I think that was the last time I saw him. But still, we're talking over 10 years ago. Maybe even, wait, I don't even think my son was born yet. So maybe 18 years ago. But yeah, I don't know why he hasn't embraced Jellyfish in the way that, in terms of just speaking about it publicly. Because there's certainly a whole lot of people who would want to talk to him about it.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
And I don't keep tabs on what people are doing.
Well, so I don't think it's just, and then we can move on, but it's just interesting because, you know, Jason Faulkner has a ton of personality. He's super outgoing. And even though it ended very badly, I think that's accurate. Nobody's going to say, you know, Jason and Andy, for whatever reason, there were heads that were butting and stuff.
Yeah.
He's very happy, acknowledges that it was great. Didn't work out for him personally, but I mean, he was more than okay to talk about it. And I found that with all of them.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
There's a pride. Every one of them. And I said to Roger, I said, man, I don't want to, you know, bug you. I know this is a million years ago for you and you're doing Licorice Quartet right now.
Sure.
But he said, no, I'm proud of it. I'm happy to talk about it.
That's great.
So it's not like Jellyfish sucked or the critics hated it, or I mean, I would say in some ways there are more people talk about it more now than they did in the early 90s. I mean, they were just a circumstance. They were a terrible time to come out with those two albums because grunge came out and just kind of blew everything out of the water.
That's my feeling too. It was just the timing wasn't quite right for that kind of band.
Yeah. If I wrote something that good, I'd talk to anybody about it. Yeah. Right? Oh my goodness.
It's a conjecture of why. You know, maybe it was just a period of his life, personally, that he doesn't want to have to revisit. I mean, that's just a guess.
So what do you
I'm sure that he's proud of the music. I mean, he's got to be.
No, I would think so. Absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely.
So I was going to ask you, I forgot what I was going to ask you. So what do you like to do for fun, Lyle? Like when you're not... I assume that's your home studio, right? Behind you. I see your Marshall head stuff. Do you like to decompress and do other things and just get your head out of music, or is it 24/7 music? What's your life like for that?
Well, it's having a family, spending time with the wife and my son, and, you know, playing some basketball or riding my bike. But I'm pretty consumed by music. I like watching getting into good TV shows and films and things like that.
We've had a lot of time to do that, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
So can you watch TV and not think about the score the whole time? Can you just enjoy it? Or is it like a football coach who watches football and says, oh my God, the left tackle missed that block?
Well, I'm always listening because I want to learn. Mm-hmm. I want to learn how to expand what I do. And so you can't help but not listen. Like any, for a musician, same thing. If you're listening to music, but you're kind of also thinking, well, what's going on there? What's harmonically happening? And why do I like it so much? Or how did that guy play that certain riff on the guitar? What is it? So there's always a built-in amount of analyzation, if that's the right word.
Yeah.
When you're listening to something that you're part of in that field. Same applies to watching films and TV. So I'm listening for the score, and sometimes it's like, oh, I really like it. And sometimes like, oh, they didn't quite, I don't, you know, could be sort of formulaic and I don't always blame the composer. Sometimes that's what's called for. You know, it has to be fitting and appropriate.
Yeah. In fact, I was watching, because I got into, documentaries, you get into those too. So the documentary on the Sparks was on. Have you watched? You haven't watched it yet?
I have watched. I just watched it a couple nights ago.
So there's so much to unpack with that. We don't have time to talk all about that. But I think the common thread is that I know that you worked with Todd Rundgren early in your career, and they did as well. And Todd just got in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So what when you work with Todd and what does Todd bring to the equation? What do you think he brings? Well, how does he help bands become better?
Well, I think he just brings an extensive use of the studio and production to the party. You know, certainly in the case of the work that we did, the Bourgeois Tag record, Yo-Yo was produced by Todd, or co-produced with Todd and two of the central songwriters in the band, or maybe I can't remember how it was labeled. Maybe it was executive produced by the two guys in the band. But yeah, Todd just, you know, just the sounds that he got were really cool. And his ideas were he just had a lot of great ideas, very tied into the lyrics. He was very very tough on lyricists. You know, he would challenge them if he didn't think it was was lyrically up to snuff. He would he wouldn't be shy.
Well, I would tell everybody to watch the Sparks documentary. I knew who they were, but I did not know. I mean, they've been going at it since 1966. I mean,
yeah,
I'm 53 and I wasn't even alive in 1966. It's, right. I mean, it's amazing the tenacity and the work ethic. And, you know, I have siblings and I love them, but I don't think I could. Well, I'm pretty sure I couldn't work with them. Like, I'd want to strangle them at some point, right? I mean, there's a lot of interesting dynamics to that band.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah. For people who are following, what's the best way to follow you, Lyle, that are hearing this and want to learn more about you?
Well, I have a Facebook musician page.
Okay.
And I have Instagram. Mm-hmm. I have Twitter, but I'm not active on that Twitter.
You're smart. It's just a time suck when people are just mean to each other. So
yeah.
The thing that I always enjoy with people like you and, you know, people like Roger or Jason or, you know, whoever, there's an obvious love for what you do. And that comes through what you do. I mean, it comes through your music and your art. And I'm very appreciative of that because it's not easy, right? It's a labor of love.
Absolutely. A lot of times it is. but yeah, I love it. I don't know what else I would do.
Well, I hope you never have to find out.
Is that a deluxe reverb behind you or a little Princeton reverb? What is that?
That is a 1983 Fender Superchamp.
Oh, it's a Superchamp.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those are cool amps.
Oh, I love it.
Those were, I think, Paul Rivera, I think, had something to do
with it. Paul Rivera. That's totally right. It's one of those things that I've moved all over the country. The Superchamp has been with me the entire time. I was 19 when I bought it. It was 4 years old at the time, and I've lugged it everywhere. I love it. I use it to record.
Yeah.
To this day.
I want to hear one of those amps again. I haven't heard them since when they were popular and they come out.
Well, I have your email. I'll send you my podcast theme song. I'm playing through a Superchamp the whole time.
Oh, so. Okay. Go. I appreciate that.
No, it's just a lot of, you know, you're like the third person to notice it. And I honestly, God, I don't put it there as a prop. I actually use it.
Yeah.
But there's such a great amp. I've had a couple people say, want to buy it? And I'm like, I'm not selling it. I like it too much. And it's got a great jazz. You can make it sound really great with a jazz kind of setup too. It's great. Right.
Yeah. I have to seek one of those out at some point.
All right. Well, if I see one for sale, I will let you know.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Lyle, you have a good day and I'll send you the link. If you have any questions, and if I ever sell the Superchamp, I'll let you know.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, James.
Have a good one.
You too.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye. Lyle Workman, everybody. And I'm with Lyle. I love strings. I mean, how cool is this? This is his new album that came out this year, Uncommon Measures. And as we talked about, this is with the strings that he recorded at Abbey Road Studios. I mean, talk about a bucket list item. That's very amazing. So please check out Lyle. I put in the show notes where you can follow him and look at him and check out this new album that came out this year. And that's going to do it for today's episode of Trading Fours. But next time, 1 week from today, December 11th, I will have on a fellow native of Lincoln, Nebraska, fellow alum of Lincoln Southeast High School. But we haven't chatted ever before. His name is Josh Hoyer. He is a fabulous keyboardist and singer. He has a band, Josh Hoyer and the Soul Colossal. And they are actually going to be in Kansas City at the Ship on December 17th. So we're going to talk all about that show. So until then, go out, support live music, and we'll talk real soon. Bye-bye.